launched its military operations. They confidently claimed the strikes would just last a few days. But upon entering the war with Yemen, Trump discovered what many had learned before him. Starting a war in Yemen is easy. Escaping its endless trap is where the real fight begins.
These U.S. airstrikes against innocent Yemenis and against Yemen came with the goal to protect and secure Israel and to stop Yemen from its support for Palestine. They have failed to achieve this main task. The biggest proof for this is that Yemen continues to attack Israel and has even expanded its operations targeting Ben Gurion Airport and forcing it to close along with attacking more Israeli sites.
And that's because Yemen is constantly developing and manufacturing more advanced weapons at a record speed. According to military experts in Yemen, this accelerated development is baffling American military planners and reshaping battlefield calculations.
Today, Yemen's armed forces have acquired superior military means across the board, weapons that can hit with more precision and hit at greater distances against U.S. targets. This is changing the balance of power in this war in favor of the Yemeni people and the axis of resistance.
As Washington scrambles for answers, Yemen isn't just withstanding the assault, it's rewriting the rules of the battle.
According to Yemen's defense minister, the armed forces have made significant progress in developing new weapons, which could soon be used to target additional U.S. positions on both land and sea. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
A very bleak and somber day in Gaza marking the start of Eid al-Fitr. The scenes here in the central part of the Gaza Strip are not the same and the usual ones. Empty streets, closed shops, and grieving families everywhere. And all that reverberated through is just the echoes of the strikes and artillery shells all around the Strip. Nonetheless, people wore new clothes and adorned their despair-filled streets, holding mere demonstrations of delight and steadfastness, and hoping that their suffering will know a very permanent end.
I hope the war will end, and we will spend the Eid as all other people. I wish to go to swings and play, not to be trapped and suffer like this. I was happy here with this initiative. We had some entertaining activities that brought us happiness. I'll also go to my aunt's home like others.
Despite the endlessly lingering consequences of the Israeli genocide in Gaza and the unbearable trauma people have been subjected to during the last 17 months, the Eid comes at a time of grief and unending trauma. The children here in Deir al-Balah, who are internally displaced from their homes, have finally found out a glimmer of peace and joy to vent their pain, and their hope and resilience have never changed. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir al-Balah, Central Gaza, Occupied Palestine.
The Constitutional Declaration was expected to lay the foundation for a democratic transition that represents all Syrians. Instead, it centralized power in the hands of Jolani, granting him absolute control over government appointments, including ministers, third of the parliament, and a committee that will appoint the rest, while restricting any oversight on his authority.
The declaration contradicts the aspirations of Syrians for democracy, political pluralism, and peaceful power transition. Instead of allowing the people to elect their leaders, it strips them of that right. Even the parliament can neither grant confidence to the government nor hold it accountable.
Critics argue that the declaration lacks true democratic foundations, concentrating authority in a single leader rather than ensuring fair representation for all components of Syrian society. The disappointment appeared in the small number of people celebrating the anniversary of the Syrian revolution, which did not exceed a few hundred.
Unfortunately, the Constitutional Declaration leans away from democracy, placing excessive power in the hands of the president and excluding genuine participation. Worse, it addresses transitional justice selectively shifting all blame to one side instead of ensuring accountability for all parties.
Beyond legal concerns, recent events on the Syrian coast have raised serious fears about the country's future. Armed factions linked to the new regime have been accused of grave human rights violations, including mass killings, acts that some experts warn may amount to crimes of genocide.
What happened in the Syrian coastal region raises serious concerns about the future and the potential for further oppression. While I hope for a solution that satisfies all Syrians, the current situation leaves many in fear of what's to come.
As Syrians grapple with a deepening crisis, the constitutional declaration has only added to political discontent and growing fears about the country's future. With power concentrated at the top and violence escalating, hopes for democracy seem more distant than ever. Ali Mohammed, Damascus.
In his annual meeting with government officials and foreign ambassadors on the occasion of Eid al-Fitr, Iran's leader has called this religious celebration a shared practice that can help unite Muslim nations and as a result offer them protection against the enemy's aggression, such as the ongoing genocide in Gaza. An example of using people's support in a geographically strategic location to unite with the oppressed is Yemen, a nation that has successfully imposed maritime restrictions on the Israeli regime for its genocidal war on Gaza.
The Yemeni nation today has stood up against this aggression as we believe that the true power is with God Almighty. The Yemeni nation's trust is with God and the people's movement. With the honorable people standing by us in the resistance front, God willing, we will defeat the enemy.
In Iran, support for the Palestinian cause came with the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
From the early days of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, supporting Palestine has been one of the ideals of Iran to which the nation, the officials, and leader have remained loyal.
Since the parliament represents the people and they demand support for Palestine, we have taken legal action against the slaughter of Palestinians and the destruction of their land, among other steps.
Our stance is completely clear on the unwavering support for the resistance, which is a fundamental policy based on the ideals of the Islamic Revolution, as Iran's leader reiterated today. While resistance groups act independently, Iran will continue to support them.
Of course, standing up against world powers in solidarity with the oppressed comes at a price, which could be lessened if more Muslim nations joined in, and Eid al-Fitr is a great reminder of that responsibility. For millions of Muslims across the world, Eid al-Fitr presents a fresh start and an opportunity to unite to restore peace and security and Muslim dignity. Maryam Azarchar, Tehran.
Amid relentless Israeli bombardment, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza performed Eid al-Fitr prayers over the rubble of destroyed mosques in displacement shelters and besides the ruins of their homes. The destruction of homes and places of worship has left many Palestinians with nowhere to gather for Eid prayers, further deepening the sense of loss during this sacred time.
This Eid comes at a very depressing time and amid circumstances of death, starvation, and bombing. But the people in Gaza insist on celebrating Eid despite everything, even if it only means performing the Eid prayer.
Reviving the spirit of Eid is an attempt by the people of Gaza to momentarily escape the Israeli resumption of the genocide and the grave humanitarian crisis caused by the ongoing blockade. However, the Israeli occupation insists on staining this day in particular with bloodshed and massacres.
I only came to the Eid prayer to fulfill a religious duty. However, there is no joy or happiness for us. As you can see, the mosque is destroyed, but despite that, they cannot erase our faith from our hearts, and we must pray.
In the 24 hours leading up to the Eid, the Israeli massacre intensified, leaving at least 50 Palestinians killed, the majority of whom were young children playing close to the tents while dressed in minimally available Eid clothing.
This third Eid since the beginning of the genocide concludes with the sounds of the takbirs being mingled with the explosions of the artillery shells falling on the tents and the homes of the people, killing the children and burying their laughter under the rubble of their homes. and making this trip even a wider slaughterhouse at Ibrahim Gaza City.
Here in Al Mawasi area in Western Khan Yunis is one of the few amusement parks across the Gaza Strip, a place that once represented joy and celebratory moments for children and their families who are welcoming Eid after the end of the holy month of Ramadan. This place that was once vibrant with children and their families, the echoing of their laughter as they are riding these games that are now standing idle, surrounded by hundreds of tents that were constructed by the Palestinian families who were forced out of their towns and were forced into endless cycles of displacement for more than a year now. These tents are now overshadowing this scene of having these games and joy for children.
This park used to be a reminder of fun and joyful times for families. For 2 years now, the occupation has stolen our happiness, depriving us of all our special celebrations. It's Eid, a time when we should be baking cookies and decorating our homes, but instead, we are homeless. Happiness has become an impossible wish these days.
This amusement park was filled with green spaces to receive the families in such special occasions. But what really gave this park its joyful aspect is the existence of many of the games like the Ferris wheel, the pirate ships, the roller coaster, and all our modest games. But today, as the families are welcoming the Eid, these games stand idle. There's no way to power them because the families can barely find and secure their basic humanitarian needs. And now all these games are surrounded by this miserable scenes of tents, of displacement and suffering.
As we welcome Eid, all we wish for is for this genocide to end. For a year, we have been away from our homes, sheltering in a place we never imagined we'd be. We once brought our children here to celebrate and have fun on this special day, but now we can't even get them with new clothes or offer them safety.
For the second year in a row, the Palestinians across the Gaza Strip welcome the festive Eid al-Fitr with nothing but more miseries and suffering. This place that should be filled with the laughters of children is now covered and overshadowed by the miserable scene of displacement that doesn't seem to end any soon for the families here. Ahmed al-Najjar, Al-Mawasi.
Arabi English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to Arabi English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Arabi English Radio.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by his power and brought the sight-giving day through his mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. Now imagine enduring over 8 years of daily bombings and artillery attacks on your country, coupled with a crippling siege on your ports, denying the entry of basic supplies to your civilian population, the death, destruction, hunger, displacement, and disease that your people suffer. Now imagine that onslaught no sooner subsides that the same nightmare has just become someone else's fresh debacle. Such is the story of Yemen, a resilient people who resisted a Western-backed campaign behind the Saudis to subjugate Yemen can be enjoying peace today and working on rebuilding their war-torn nation, but instead, they have chosen to fight for their brethren in Palestine. Yemen's anti-Israel and anti-U.S. operations to bring an end to the genocide in and the siege of the Gaza Strip is a focus of our Spotlight program. And now for our guests. Joining us is Mr. Saad Nimr, Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University in occupied Ramallah. And Mr. McNapier, co-founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess Professor Saad Nimr, we'll start with you. Welcome, sir. Your initial thoughts, how justifiably so the people of Yemen today can say we are beat up, we are hungry, too tired to fight, Yet they show nothing but will and fortitude when it comes to Palestine, and in fact have implored and lambasted other Arab and Muslim leaders for not doing their part in supporting Palestinians.
I think that maybe the only people who can feel with us quite well are the Yemenis, because they've been through that in the last, you know, for 8 years of a war, which was launched against them, supported by America, and they make them, you know, suffer a lot. And then they saw the same thing is happening to the Palestinian people, and especially the genocide war against the Palestinians, especially in Gaza. And they felt the same feeling, you know, for the Palestinian. And no one stand with Yemen during that period. And they said, now we should stand by the Palestinians. And that's why they were, you know, out of lots of reasons, Yemenis are committed to help the Palestinians. And through the whole period of the war against Gaza, they were joining, and they joined, and they had an embargo on the Israeli shipments, closing their ports, and closing the Red Sea for sailing, or anyone who's serving Israel as well. And that makes them, you know, feel the same feeling as they felt during the war of 8 years of Saudi Arabia and Emirates, who launched it against the Houthis. Now they are doing the same to the Palestinian and helping the Palestinian when no one of the Arab countries had helped them during this war. And that's why they felt, I think that this is the main reason. And also their commitments as Arabs, as Muslims, as also humans who would help the Palestinian. For all these reasons, they were there to help the Palestinian people in Gaza.
Thank you, Professor Nimmer. Mr. McNapier, welcome to the conversation, sir. Thank you for your patience. Just moments ago, less than an hour ago, we had breaking news here. A series of 13 intense airstrikes by U.S. warplanes again have targeted the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, following earlier strikes that resulted in at least one dead and five wounded. Mick, obviously Yemen, at a considerable cost to itself, continues to stand militarily against the wholesale slaughter of Palestinian people in this three-week siege now on the entry of all aid into the besieged Gaza Strip. How do you assess Yemen saying that its stance here is a sense of duty and obligation to stand with the Palestinian people?
It's so clear. It's really good people versus bad people. It's if you were looking at the world from outer space, you would see the genocide taking place in a small place called Palestine, and silence and gloom elsewhere, and active support from some governments. But you would see Yemen. You would see that this was a place where vast numbers of people actually took a practical stand. We know that all over the world, great numbers of people in every country oppose what America is doing. Great majority of people in Britain oppose what America is doing. But we're unable to reach the stage where we can give practical support to the Palestinians facing a genocidal monstrosity. And the Yemenis have taken this action. As Saad Nimmer points out, it's the fruit of experience. We're coming up, actually, I just saw, we're coming up to about 10 years anniversary. About 10 years ago, the Saudis commemorated or even celebrated the first stage of their attempts to subjugate Yemen. And in order to celebrate this stage, Prince Walid bin Talal offered all 100 Saudi pilots who were dropping American bombs on Yemen, and had been doing so for many years, he offered every single pilot a Bentley car. Now, the revulsion around the world was so great, I don't know if he actually delivered the cars, but it brought into sharp relief the disgusting nature of this extremely wealthy and powerful state, Saudi Arabia, trying to bomb the Yemenis into the ground, and thinking 10 years ago that they had succeeded, reached the end of the first stage. So I think the Americans need to learn from this. The Americans have slaughtered people in country after country, it should be noted, quite successfully, in order to crush opposition and drown it in blood. But when they came to a particular country, Vietnam, they encountered a population which was determined to resist, a people, and with a leadership that was determined to resist. That's the situation in Yemen. It's a very different situation in many ways, but they meet a population who demonstrate in their millions every Friday in support of the challenge to Israel, in support of the challenge to the USA, which clearly enjoys mass support and a leadership which really seems to be determined to pick up this challenge and come to the aid of the Palestinians. It's genocide. Regimes are silent. Many regimes are supporting the genocide, and the Yemenis are coming out practically in support. This will not be forgotten when the history books are written. And I think the Yemenis' approach from a tremendous history of resistance, but they also approach from a knowledge, they're sitting in a very strategic waterway. And they can, if they can absorb the punishment from the Americans, they can deliver a significant blow to the Western economy. And they've proven that already. If they hold their ground, then Trump, by the way, Trump was elected on a platform of ending foreign wars. And now he says that he'll bomb Yemen without any limit of time. This doesn't play well in America. But this is what Trump's trying to do. If the Yemenis can hold on, can continue to resist, there are many strong forces which suggest that they could be successful.
Thank you, Mr. Napier. And Professor Nimmer, we know that during the first 15 and a half months leading up to the January 19th implementation of the Gaza ceasefire, Yemenis put a ban on, according to Mr. Napier, the strategic waterways. Any Israeli-linked vessel was not allowed to access those waterways, and it nearly 200-plus vessels were commandeered for trying to get goods into occupied ports of Palestine there. And then next to that, the Yemenis also, they engaged with missiles and drone operations against the occupied ports of Palestine, we know, in support of the Palestinian people. And they said they will stop once the Gaza ceasefire is implemented, and they did. Post January 19th, we didn't see any more operations from the Yemenis. So we have to ask, when we know that that Gaza ceasefire was so pressing and its implementation so effective and it brought so much tensions to an end, why did the U.S. allow it to fail?
Well, you are absolutely right. I mean, the Yemenis had put a kind of a condition. If you cease fire in Gaza, we will stop our operations against the any vessels who are carrying, whatever goods to Israel military or otherwise through the Red Sea. And they did, because they caused the Israeli really a huge kind of losses, especially when they targeted Eilat port in Rashrash, and also targeted even Tel Aviv with hypersonic rockets. But at the same time, they said if there is a ceasefire and Israel stop this genocide in Gaza, we will stop, because we are supporting the Palestinians, and this is what we are doing. So if you have a ceasefire, we will do it. So when ceasefire goes on, the Yemenis is stopped, and they respected their decision, and they stopped all kind of operations in the Red Sea. And even Israel and the other countries could use the Red Sea and the Arab Sea freely now without any threats. But what happened? Then the Israeli came out and they started this starvation and blocking all the crossings in with Gaza, preventing the Palestinians from food, water, oil, and everything which is related to their daily life. And now for more than a month, a Palestinian now really suffering really a hunger problem. So the Yemeni said, if you don't stop, then we will resume, because this is an act of war. And they just threatened. They didn't do anything yet. Yet the United States, they started bombarding Yemen before Yemeni do anything. It's quite clear that the United States, and especially Trump, his policies in the region definitely is, as Mick said, it's contrary to what he was elected supposedly for, to talk about, peace, and that he want to bring peace into the area, and he preparing that to resume the Abraham Accords, according to him. But at the same time, he's showing, a real problems with the Middle East and supporting Israel and supporting what the Israeli wanted. So he started and resumed bombarding Yemen again, even before Yemen start any kind of only threat to resume the war. And they gave the Israeli 4 days in order to stop this blocking of aid to enter, and humanitarian aid to enter to Gaza. I believe that the American have an idea that they wanted to eliminate the Yemenis from doing anything, and they have the what during Biden administration it didn't work. The UK and US, both of them, they bombarded Yemen many times, and it didn't work. So Trump thought more power and more bombardment to Yemen, that will make the problem end. But it's not going to end, and the Yemenis are not going to be defeated.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Mr. McNapier, when Abdul Malik al-Houthi, leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, said in mid-March he gave Israel an ultimatum, a four-day ultimatum, to lift a siege on Gaza, Israel went and allowed the whole ceasefire at that point to go belly up, as you very well know. But Yemen had not resumed its anti-Israel operations yet when, Professor Nimmer's point, and very accurately so, the U.S. started attacking Yemen. So my question to you, the fact that all this could have been avoided if the U.S. would have pushed the Israelis to respect the ceasefire, one, and two, the fact that the Yemenis are dictating terms to the U.S. and Israel, what does that say about the Yemenis themselves?
It says much for the character and the integrity and the confidence, but also the courage and the understanding of the balance of forces by the Yemeni leadership. The Americans aren't used to being talked to like this. They expect everyone around the world to kowtow, to accept their leadership. But you know, I think this is much deeper than a policy. I think that Israel needs to survive in this area as a murderous regime based on the mass killing of Arabs and Muslims. Israel needs to be surrounded by states which are either devastated, like Syria, Libya, Iraq, or clients, supine clients of the empire. Anything else is unacceptable because Israel is extremely vulnerable. We're talking about 6 million Zionist Jews, probably, maybe less, maybe fewer than that, who are prepared to fight, surrounded by 600 million, I think, is one calculation of the number of Arabs. And they can switch on their TV sets and see Arabs being killed because they're Arabs. Muslims around the world can switch on their... They kill Christian Palestinians as well, but they can mainly see Muslims being killed by this Islamophobic regime because they're Palestinian Muslims. How to survive in that area is not easy. If you imagine six people in a room trying to control 600... It's not easy. You have to divide them. You have to make them afraid. You have to terrorize them. It's the same with 7 million and 600 million. So Israel is deeply fragile, and it can only survive in that area as an ethnic cleansing operation by, as I said, devastating those states which refuse to be clients. So I think there's something profound here. Israel wants to continue with the killing. And the price for continuing with the killing is that the Yemenis will come to their aid, and then America has to be called upon to bomb the Yemenis. It's worth pointing out, by the way, that although he huffs and puffs, Netanyahu, when he meets Trump, understands that Trump is the boss. That's clear from recent developments. But it's also clear that the basic idea of Zionism, which sold itself to Britain initially and then to America as an attack dog in the area, a way in which America could avoid becoming entangled because Israel would do the fighting for it. We now see that with the Yemenis coming into the equation, America has to intervene to save Israel, not delegate the role in the whole region of attack dog to Israel. So I think this is a profound crisis for the Zionists. We don't know how this will play out inside Israeli society. Sadnimer's insights into this would be valuable. But I think America generally tries to solve its problems by great violence, by aircraft carriers, by B-52 bombs, etc., etc. But they seem to have come up against an enemy here, an opponent, which is different from the rest. Because the majority of people in Egypt, of course, support the Palestinians, but the regime is completely different. What you have is a unity between the people in Yemen and the leadership, and that's very dangerous for the Americans and for the Israelis.
And that's the thing, Professor Nimer, because Abdel Malik al-Houthi, the leader of Yemen's Ansarullah movement, he's implored other Arab and regional leaders to stand with Yemen and its operations and its stance against the U.S. and Zionist plots, saying that their plans go far beyond the Palestinian people and Palestine, that they are an existential threat to the region and the nations of the region itself.
Well, yes. Let me just remind you with something. When the Yemenis managed to impose this embargo on the Israeli entity generally and prevent the Red Sea delivery of any kind of commercial ships to come to Israel from that side, Israel suffered a lot. What the Arab did, Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and through Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and to Jordan, there was a line of supplies of food and everything which was missing to go to Israel. So Arabs, instead of standing with the Palestinians, to the contrary, they were solving the problems of Israel, which the Yemenis has imposed. So when Abdel Malik al-Houthi is asking all the other Arabs to do at least, you know, the minimum they should do in this case, if you don't want to stand with the Palestinians and to fight Israel, at least don't help Israel. This is something, you know, unbelievable. So his call for the Arab leaders is really because it's shame for those Arab countries, because as Mick said just a minute ago, they are clients to the Israelis and the American also supremacy over the area. Let me just, you know, say at the same time, we are talking about also Egypt and Qatar. Both countries are now accommodating the talks between the Israelis and the Americans and the Palestinians in order to have a ceasefire in Gaza. But at the same time, they are applying pressure on Hamas and on the Palestinian resistance rather than applying pressure on Israel. Why they didn't stand up and say it is Israel who is breaking all these agreements, it's not the Palestinians? But they didn't say that, which is the minimum. You've been there and you've been a mediator and you know exactly what's going on. Why at least you didn't just tell the truth of what happened during these negotiations and who break the agreement and who's committed to the agreement? So it's something sometimes, you know, it makes you think of what kind of Arabs and Muslims we are talking about here. So al-Houthi, when he talked, Abdel Malik al-Houthi, when he asked Arabs and other countries, you know, to help, at least he would put them in front of their responsibilities, which they are not even doing the minimum that they should do.
And thank you there. And Mr. Napier, let's also touch on Yemen's military advance, its evolution of its arsenal there. When the Saudi-led coalition started attacking Yemen back in March of 2015, I believe Yemen did not have a remarkable drone arsenal. It had pretty crude missiles at the time. Today, it has hypersonic missiles reaching Tel Aviv. It has these super-fast frigates all over the Red Sea. It has multiple types of drones, all homegrown, sophisticated, indigenous-built equipment. In 10 years' time, tell us how remarkable the military advancements for Yemen have been.
Well, I'm far from a military expert, but I do know that it was technological advances which almost allowed the Egyptian soldiers in 73 to inflict a devastating defeat on Israel. Instead, they fought to a draw. It was the technological developments which worked against Israel. I think the same is true here today. The distance between Yemen and Israel is significant, but Israel is very vulnerable with its airports and its advanced infrastructure and its nuclear power stations and so on. Israel's very vulnerable to the missiles that can be fired from Yemen. And the Yemenis have a strong hand. They have been fighting against... It was the Saudis who dropped the American bombs by proxy for so many years. Now the Americans are dropping the bombs themselves. But Israel remains very vulnerable to an attack from Yemen. So I think the balance of power is such that, I think generally speaking, the Palestinians cannot win their freedom by themselves. Despite the amazing achievements of the Palestinian resistance, they cannot defeat America, the EU, Britain, Canada, etc., ranged against them. This needs to be solved at a regional level. And Israel cannot survive for a year without the active complicity of Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, and the other regimes which Saad referred to. Without that complicity, they could not carry on the way they are doing. So the genocide can only be carried out with the connivance and the active complicity, as Saad points out. The Yemenis asked permission, I think, a couple of years ago. Would the Saudis allow the Yemenis to march to fight the Israelis? That's all they needed to do, open the borders and let them go to fight. But the Saudis actually actively cooperate with the Israelis against the resistance. That's the sad truth. And until that situation has changed, the Palestinians will always remain in great peril from this genocidal regime and its local backers.
Thank you, Mr. McNapier. And Professor Nimmer, final question to you. We know Donald Trump has threatened Yemen with this hell on earth to pay if they don't stop attacking Israel and Israeli-linked vessels. He really likes that one. He said Hamas in Gaza, hell on earth, hell to pay. Iran, hell to pay, hell on earth. Yemen, hell on earth. But you remember when you mentioned a fire and fury with North Korea in his first term, that got the attention of the North Koreans. Kim Jong-un met with them a couple times. They sat down, they spoke. But the Yemenis seem very unfazed with the U.S. president's threats. Why?
Well, apparently Trump, first of all, he liked this word, you know, hell on earth, and he used it frequently. But at the same time, there is something he missed, that there are, you know, lots of changes had happened to the region and to the world before, you know, like, you know, I'm not talking about the 60s and the 70s when he could send his troops over any country and to defeat this country. Now the whole game is changed, and the way it changed. And after the 7th of October, we have witnessed now something is regional is being changed as well, when Hezbollah and Ansar Allah in Yemen also participated in this war. So he's threatening, but at the same time, he couldn't do anything to Yemen. Sorry. Threatening Gaza with hell after 15 months of genocide. What he would do more? And Yemen, after 8 years of war, which was supported by American, by the way, what kind of things that he could do more to the Yemenis more than 8 years? So the Yemenis, they do know exactly what the Americans are able to do, and at the same time, they can resist them and they can fight back. At the same time, Yemenis are insisting. He didn't know even the psychology of the Yemenis and the culture of the Yemenis. And this is something, it's far away from the mind of Trump. He thought that he can threaten anyone and they should comply immediately after his threat. This is something he had to learn, that this is have changed. Neither Hamas or the Houthis will change their mind.
Great input and contributions to the program. Thank you both, and appreciate having you both on. Stay safe to both of you. Professor Saad Nimmer, they're joining us out of Ramallah, and Mr. McNapier, they're joining us out of Glasgow, United Kingdom. That brings us to the end of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
Wow. We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
This so-called catch-and-revoke program in the United States of America, which uses artificial intelligence to deport international students that are deemed pro-Palestinian, sets a worrying precedent for freedom of speech in the U.S. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Middle East iWrote, Axios reported recently, citing senior State Department officials of the United States, the Trump administration's plan to use artificial intelligence to deport international students that are deemed pro-Palestinian has received a wide range of reactions this week from across political spectrum, stirring fears of what this could mean for free speech in the U.S. The U.S. State Department reported plans to use artificial intelligence to revoke the visas of foreign students who are deemed pro-Hamas. The catch-and-revoke project, launched by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, according to Axios, will see AI-assisted reviews of tens of thousands of student visa holders' social media accounts and marks a dramatic escalation in the U.S. government's policing of foreign nationals conducting a speech. Rubio took to X recently to announce measures against students, saying the U.S. has zero tolerance for foreign visitors who support terrorists, violators of U.S. law. According to reports, the U.S. State Department has already revoked the visa of one unidentified student. The U.S. officials told Axios the reviews of social media accounts are particularly looking for evidence of alleged terrorist sympathies expressed after Al-Aqsa storm operation on October 7, 2023, on 1,000 occupied territories called Israel. Catch and revoke is one of the many escalations that have occurred this week in stifling momentum for the pro-Palestine student movement. In addition to President Donald Trump's cancellation of a $400 million grant to Columbia and the beginning of an investigation into the University of California over concerns surrounding anti-Semitism. Reactions to the announcement have received both criticism and praise, with many questions as to what this could mean for freedom of speech in general in the United States of America. In response to the announcement, many say that catch and revoke goes against U.S. law and that internationals on student visas are protected by the First Amendment and they have the right to freedom of speech. Human rights organization Amnesty International USA posted on X, "Reminder, Mr. President, all people, regardless of immigration status, including students and faculty, have the right to peaceful assembly and freedom of expression, no matter the subject matter. If news reports are true, catch and revoke is an awful idea and an attack on human rights." Those that are in support of deporting international pro-Palestine student protesters argue that students that participated in encampments or sit-ins are not protected by the First Amendment. One person posted on X, "Free speech allows people to protest outside as long as they are not blocking or harming anyone. However, free speech does not include preventing others from learning or causing harm. Coming to this country to study is a privilege, not a right." Others who oppose catch and revoke have also pointed out that those who participate in pro-Palestine protests on campus, as well as the students who have vocally criticized the Zionist regime online, should not automatically be deemed as sympathizers to resistance movements. Palestinian-American academic Iman Abdullah Hadi took on X to call out those she believes gave the Trump administration permission to escalate the situation on pro-Palestine students to this extent. "Everyone from Democrats to university admin who helped perpetuate the lie that critique or protest of Israel was inherently anti-Semitic or constituted harassment of Jewish students, you handed the university to the right on a golden platter." An anonymous user on X, who says they are an international student, says that the news of catch and revoke has made them even more fearful of protesting for Palestine. Another point of contention for many online is the government's use of artificial intelligence in identifying so-called pro-Palestinian students. The CIA-backed analytics firm being used for the subject, Palantir, is infamous for being used by the Zionist regime to facilitate its targeting of Palestinians and for its advanced capabilities in its war on Gaza. One person posted on X, "If you didn't know, Palantir is a company that generates kill lists for Palestinians in Gaza for the IDF. Now, this same kind of contact tracing tech is being employed in the United States for bad or for good. If they can use this AI to go after Hamas sympathizers, they can use this to go after any one of us at any time for any reason." Another echoed sentiment saying that catch and revoke is a beta test for US citizens. Those that voted for Trump have also expressed frustration with the administration for investing this much energy into censoring criticism of the fabricated regime of Israel. A person who voted for Trump posted on X, "Why are we protecting Israel so much even under our First Amendment rights of freedom of speech? I'm exhausted. I didn't vote for this. I voted for corruption, exposure, and transparency."
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Human Rights Council condemns Israel's renewed onslaught on Gaza, demanding the regime prevent genocide in the territory and lift this illegal blockade. Iran strongly condemns Israel's continued attacks on Palestinians in Gaza and the occupied West Bank, calling for international action to stop the regime's crimes. And the United States carries out dozens of fresh airstrikes on various areas across Yemen, killing more civilians and damaging infrastructure. Thank you for joining us. More Palestinians have fallen victim to Israel's incessant air and artillery strikes in Gaza as the regime's genocidal war rages on unabated across the besieged territory. One of the latest attacks hit the displaced people's tents in the southern city of Khan Yunis, killing nearly a dozen civilians. The new fatalities came after